Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did political reporting in America reach the state it's in? Modern journalists are expected to dig up dirt on candidates that provides plenty of ammunition to mudslinging campaigns, whether or not it is relevant to their fitness for public service. That standard fell away abruptly in the spring of 1987. Senator Gary Hart had seemed like a shoo-in for the Democratic presidential nomination and a very strong contender for the White House itself, until journalists aggressively and some would argue invasively pursued rumors of Hart's alleged affair with a woman other than his wife. Matt Bai is national political columnist for Yahoo News and former correspondent for The New York Times Magazine. He covers the story and its long-term effects in his new book, All the Truth is Out, The Week Politics Went Tabloid. Matt, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be here, and thank you for reading the book.
Sure. It was my pleasure. For the benefit of listeners who might have been too young to follow the story in real time back in the 80s, can you remind us of the basic circumstances that led Gary Hart to suspend his campaign?
Yes, although it's a long, winding, and I think very compelling story, which is, at the heart of the book. But Hart was, as you alluded to in your intro, the Hillary Clinton of his day. He was 20 points ahead of other Democrats. He was double digits ahead of George H.W. Bush, the sitting vice president. He had come from nowhere to almost win the 1984 Democratic nomination, from 3% in the polls to winning every state west of the Mississippi, and only really the superdelegates, which were brand new at that time, kept him from taking that nomination from Walter Mondale. But there are lots of rumors about his personal life, which are never written about to that point. And then the Miami Herald gets a tip about him meeting a woman, and they place him under surveillance, hidden surveillance, for about 48 hours. And you come to this this remarkable scene in 1987, almost forgotten now, and much of the story misremembered. But you come to this remarkable scene where, if you think back, Franklin Roosevelt or Lyndon Johnson and John Kennedy for a moment, and think about how private behavior and personal lives had very little bearing on public integrity for most of the 20th century. And then you have this moment in 1987 where the presumed nominee of the Democratic Party is standing in an oil-stained alley outside his townhouse, wearing a white hoodie late at night, literally pinned up against a brick wall by four reporters and a photographer from the Miami Herald, who are saying to him, "Who is that woman in your house, and how long have you known her, and did you have sex with that woman?" Several times. And in that ground, really, the everything we've known about politics and political journalism really shifts, and it begins several days of a sort of manic rhythm of scandal that we would become accustomed to in later years, but that was really the first satellite age scandal, moving at a rapid pace that no one could quite control. And within 5 days, Hart is out of the race and disgraced, and his political career is not only over, but really his career in public service is over. And part of what I've tried to do in the book is not just follow how that week reverberated through the life of our politics and our journalism, which is significant, but also how it reverberated through the life and of this man and his family. Because at the heart of this, and what brought me to it, is really this very compelling human story about a character who is largely overlooked now, but who was critically important in American politics.
You admit at the outset of the book that you're fond of Gary Hart and deeply impressed by his intelligence. The first time, though, that you set out to write about him at any length in late 2002, you concluded essentially that he had himself to blame for what had gone wrong with his campaign. What caused you to reconsider that?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a journey for me, Chris, because I was a new writer at the New York Times Magazine in 2002. I spent 11 years there, but I was new there, and I saw an item about Hart thinking about running for president again. It was just a couple paragraphs, and I thought, well, that's kind of nuts, because I remembered this guy from reading about him in my college dorm room. I remembered how he was this huge thing and then just kind of went away, and it all just unraveled so quickly, and I thought, well, why does a guy who went through that kind of ordeal and is remembered as kind of a joke want to get back into this game? So I called him up, and I got on a plane, and I went to see him, and I was very impressed by his intellect and his sense of humor and his, still, the charisma still that he had. And I wrote a piece which wasn't all that kind and repeated a lot of what people already thought about him and the scandal, frankly, and he didn't like it, and I went away. But it sort of haunted me through the years. I don't like, as a writer, it's hard to explain. I hate the feeling that something, that I haven't gotten to the bottom of something, that there's another layer, and I felt like there was. And then I covered the next couple presidential campaigns for the Times Magazine, and I saw the way the candidates increasingly just looked at you like you were a hired assassin across the table, and they couldn't figure out what they were doing there with you, and they offered no complex ideas and were afraid to speak in nuance and watched every word and withdrew and withdrew. And I thought there was a connection, and then I went back and started to look into that scandal, even though people said to me, what do you care about this for? What I found was that everything we remembered about it was wrong, that all the key facts that people had taken away from that moment, who remembered it, were just not true. And that, of course, really piqued my interest. And so I at some point determined that I wanted to go back and really look at this in the kind of depth that a book contains. And it was not an intuitive idea, particularly not in 2009 when everybody was all swept up in the Obama revolution and not everyone understood it. But I think, I think people are seeing now, where that connection is. And I think it's resonating especially with a lot of younger readers and especially with a lot of younger journalists.
I'm not proud of this, but I will admit to being one of the people who remembered the story in real time, but remembered incorrectly that the way it all happened is that Hart issued this sort of foolhardy challenge to journalists to follow him around so that they took the bait on his suggestion. That is not the way it happened.
No, but Chris, you're not alone. I thought that too, and so does everybody else. It's funny how I think we forget, at a moment when there were three networks, Johnny Carson, Nightline, and a handful of national newspapers, something that was misunderstood could get cemented in a way that it can't today, because there's so much more media and alternative media and criticism and blogging, and we just didn't have that then. So that is the perception, is that Hart got up in front of the national press and said, follow me around, and then like a moron, he goes out and has an affair and he gets caught. The reality is actually more complicated, but I think very significant, which is that he does give that quote. He gives it in a moment of exasperation to a New York Times Magazine reporter at the time, E.J. Dionne. And he says, look, E.J., I don't want to talk about this. Follow me around if you want. If that's you'll be very bored, which E.J. doesn't take as a challenge, and Hart doesn't intend it that way. It's really heard as E.J. hears it as, look, that's all in the past, and let's just put it behind us. In any event, E.J. goes off to write his magazine story, which, of course, takes weeks to edit, and the quote is kind of in the story and out of the story. There's a process going on. The Herald gets its tip. They decide to put him under surveillance. They report it for a week. They commence the surveillance, and after they've commenced the surveillance, the advance copy of the magazine is in their hands, and they see the quote, follow me around. And what they do is when they write their expose the next day, they take that quote, which is coming out on that very same day in the New York Times Magazine, and they put it in their story. They credit the magazine, but they basically want, they use it to justify the story. And in the public mind from that time on, the two things get conflated, and it's as if the Herald has as if Hart has challenged reporters and the Herald has taken him up on it. The reason I say it's significant, you could say, well, a couple days in either direction, right? It's significant because in that moment, we, as I said earlier, we redrew the boundaries between political lives and private lives. And the popular interpretation has always been that Hart did that. Hart asked the press to enter his bedroom. By extension, he asked the press to enter everyone's bedroom, thereby changing the rules. And we've not only did we never take responsibility for it as an industry, but really society blamed him. I think part of the reason he remains stuck in that moment is because everybody thought, look what you wrought. And the truth is, he didn't. The Miami Herald made that decision. We as an industry made that decision. We debated it for a little while and then decided that Hart had brought it on himself. And that's the story. But I think it prevented a proper telling of that narrative and a proper accounting for the decisions that were made at that time.
Let's listen to a bit of a press conference at a place called the Hanover Inn on May 6th of 1987. And I think we're going to hear Hart and then journalist Paul Taylor.
In your remarks yesterday, you raised the issue of morality and you raised the issue of truthfulness. Let me ask you what you mean when you talk about morality, and let me be very specific. I have a series of questions about it. Is it, when you said you did nothing immoral, did you mean that you had no sexual relationship with Donna Rice last weekend or any other time you were with her? That is correct. you believe that adultery is immoral?
Yes.
Have you ever committed adultery?
I do not have to answer that question.
Well, it seems to me that the question of morality...
Because you get into some...
Was raised,
was
introduced by you in this discussion.
That's right.
And I think it's incumbent upon us to know what your definition of morality is.
Well, it includes adultery.
So you believe adultery is immoral?
Yes, I do.
Have you ever committed adultery?
I do not know. I'm not going into a theological definition of what constitutes adultery. Some people's minds, it's people being married and having relationships with other people. So.
Can I ask you whether or not you and your wife have an understanding about whether or not you can have relations with other people, you can have sexual encounters?
My inclination is to say, no, you can't answer that question, but the answer is no, we don't have that kind of understanding.
That was 1987, May 6th, 1987, news conference. You heard former Colorado Senator Gary Hart and reporter Paul Taylor. Matt, by the thing that strikes me about that is that it is, we certainly feel that, you know, the pressure is on Hart there, but it doesn't feel so unusual today. In 1987, this was an absolute jaw dropper.
Yeah, that's amazing audio, Chris. I've not heard that. I've read the transcript 100 times, but I commend you all for getting the audio. That's fantastic. It was unbelievable. In fact, I ran into someone. I did a reading in the last couple of weeks, and someone came up to me and she said I was in that room, and she said everybody's jaw dropped. And the people who were there remembered it as a very big watershed moment. No candidate had been asked that open in general a question. Yeah, sure. In the years later, it was. You know, what kind of underwear do you wear, and have you been faithful to your wife, and if your wife were raped, how would you react? And we got used to all kinds of outrageous inquiries, but that was new. And Paul Taylor wasn't just any journalist. He was the top, you know, one of the very top reporters of the Washington Post, sort of the heir to this great political franchise. And Hart, you know, interestingly, when I talked to him and we went through it, you know, he talked about what went through his mind. There's that slight pause. You can hear him. You know, what you don't hear is in the minutes before that, he was really on top of his game. He's parrying every question quite brilliantly. And then he gets caught in that moment and kind of stammers. And he said he looked out at the faces of the reporters, which were very defiant and demanding. They wanted an answer. And he thought to himself, wow, I know these reporters. They were on my plane and in my bus in 84 when I was campaigning, and I know who had affairs with who, and a lot of them were married. And he's thinking to himself, how can you turn around and demand an answer to this? And then he kind of goes through the theological, you know, he's a Bible student and a divinity student, so he goes through in his head, well, what is adultery and how do you define it and do I need to answer this? And you know, I think there's a moment of sort of surrender at the end of that exchange that you played, which I think is interesting, where Taylor then follows up and says, you know, what about your marriage? Is it non-traditional? Which is just, in 1987, an unheard of question, and I think a complicated one for Hart, frankly, although he remains married to this day for 50-odd years. And he says, my inclination is to say no. In other words, you can't ask me that question. And then he says, but the answer is no. We have a very traditional, loving marriage. And it's essentially a surrender that he realizes, maybe for the first time, that the rules have changed and they're not going back.
My guest is Matt Bai. He is national political columnist for Yahoo News, former correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, and author of the new book, All the Truth is Out, The Week Politics Went Tabloid. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Matt Bai, national political columnist for Yahoo News and a former correspondent for The New York Times Magazine. He has a new book out called All the Truth is Out, The Week Politics Went Tabloid. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Matt, I'm really interested in this because you talk about what Hart was thinking as he looked around that room of journalists who were sort of fiercely staring at him. And he's thinking, well, I know who you slept with and I know what happened to you. It strikes me that this is the moment. It's almost like, you know, something in the Garden of Eden where they're cast out of the garden, because before this time you describe a sort of I hate to use the sexist term, but like a gentleman's agreement between the press corps and politicians, which was that they would, trade off a bit of privacy and some boundaries on the part of reporters in exchange for a measure of accessibility and candor on the part of the politicians.
Yeah, and it wasn't always good. I mean, at the heart of the book, as I say, is a narrative, and the story leads where it leads, and I draw some conclusions. But it's not the idea here is not the good old days were always good, and you know, if only we could go back, there were things about John Kennedy we probably should have known, and you could say the same of other politicians. But in general, the press prior to this really only covers sex lives and really just everything related to personal life, because this isn't just about sex, right? It's about all sort of personal and private lives and behaviors. They really only cover it when it bursts out into public view and becomes a political issue, like Chappaquiddick, say, with Ted Kennedy, or Nelson Rockefeller's divorce and remarriage to a much younger woman, which was scandalous in Republican politics. And when it does get covered, it's kind of in context. It doesn't wash away an entire political career. Nelson Rockefeller comes back to be vice president. Ted Kennedy runs for president in 1980, and it's not really Chappaquiddick that does him in. So, you know, you're able to come back from it in a way that Hart was not. And part of what I talk about in the book, and I think it's very important because this sometimes gets misunderstood, is that I don't think this didn't change because the Miami Herald decided to do something different. It didn't change because Gary Hart acted differently from other candidates. It was going to change. There was a vortex of factors in our society that were sort of coming together, swirling at that moment. The echoes of Watergate, which were very strong, the feeling among this new generation of journalists that they had to find the lie and prevent the liar. Prevent another liar from getting into the White House. The example of Woodward and Bernstein, and particularly the movie All the President's Men, and the feeling suddenly among this new generation of journalists that they wanted to be famous. They wanted to find the scandal. They wanted to take someone down. You have the changing attitudes about adultery on the left because of feminism. You have changing attitudes about moral behavior on the right because of the rise of the moral forces of Ronald Reagan and the modern Republicans. And you have the birth of the satellite dish, which is really a critical factor in changing the definition of news and making it more of an entertainment-driven soap opera kind of affair. I mean, earlier that year, just before Hart, you have the Jim and Tammy Faye Baker scandal with the preacher accused of sexual misconduct and the wife with the mascara running down her face, and Ted Koppel interviews her. It's the highest-rated Nightline he does to that point. So there's a lot happening, and I think it was inevitably going this way. What I think that week in May of 1987 is just the moment where it sort of manifests itself, the moment where it tips and doesn't go back.
Let's talk about the satellite truck issue. I suppose the networks and even some local affiliates had made investments in these very, very expensive machines that allowed you to have a live shot from anywhere. It's like when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Is that what happened?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great, I mean, I love that saying, and it applies here, because that is exactly what happens when you have these really expensive new trucks and then the flyaway satellite dishes, which CNN had just started to distribute. CNN was a brand new network at that time, only about 6 years old. When you have this stuff, then the tendency is suddenly you can go live from anywhere, anytime, and you do want to cover something minute by minute, even if nothing's happening, because suddenly you have the ability to do that. And it does create more of a soap opera atmosphere, and it does create stories that develop and mushroom so fast that it's hard to get any context. And there's this great anecdote in the book from Joe Trippi, who of course goes on to become a very famous Democratic operative in his own right. He runs Howard Dean's campaign, among others. But Trippi is in his late 20s at that time, and he's a pretty junior aide in Denver at the headquarters, and they send him off to Troublesome Gulch, which is where Hart lives in a cabin. His wife, Lee, still his wife, is trapped there. Literally, I mean, no one's ever dealt with this kind of crowd control. So reporters have started showing up, and she can't get past them. She can't get out of her house. And they say to Trippi, "You're her new chief of staff. Go up there and rescue her." And this is on the same day the story breaks. So he drives up. It's about a 40-minute drive. And he gets there, and he looks. And all down the gravel drive, stretching down this deserted road, are these monstrous satellite trucks with the dishes on them. And he gets out, and he thinks to himself, "Oh, my God, they move now." Because no one's ever seen anything like this. And Trippi says a guy runs up to him with a microphone and says, I'm so-and-so from A Current Affair. And he says to the guy, he sort of pauses and says, "You mean they have a whole show for that now?" Because he's never heard of it, and he can't imagine that there's a show that does nothing but affairs, right? And this is the new world, and he confronts it. In a way, I say in the book, in a way, Trippi becomes the first operative to confront the modern scandal, because there it is, and he's the guy who gets sent there to deal with it.
What did you learn, Matt, about the discussions and debates that took place in traditional newsrooms around the country about how to handle this story specifically?
Well, it's interesting how little discussion, in a sense, there was. I mean, the Washington Post had real discussions about this, and I presume there were some at the Herald, too, although when they wrote about their account of this, there's no mention of debate. The Post had sort of split the difference and decided they would look into Hart's life, but only if they saw a pattern of recklessness that they thought was relevant would they write about it, and then the story overtook them. But what really happens for the first time is the Herald goes for the story. It's a huge tip for them, and they absolutely think it's news, and they don't really have much doubt about it. And because of the new technology, namely the fax machine, that enables people to do in a way what they would be able to do much faster with the web later, which is to shoot a story all around the country without it having to process through editors and wire services and what have you, there's really no choice. The story is everywhere all of a sudden. And even the New York Times, which has no desire to cover something like this and never has and has turned its back on stories like this forever, has to sort of drop in a story about it into the middle of the section, and then ultimately it gets to the front page. And there's this fascinating interview that David Frost did with Ben Bradlee, who, of course, just died this week. And Bradley's such a fascinating character in this, because he comes from the days of Kennedy, where he was a close friend of Kennedy and didn't write about anything that was going on, through Watergate, where he's a hero, and then to the Hart scandal, where he ends up playing a pretty significant role at the end. And Bradlee talked to Frost about this a few years after he retired. And after being really badgered about it for a while, and the difference between Kennedy and Hart, and Bradlee sort of goes back, he says, "Well, but Hart got himself caught." And Frost says, "Well, so the crime isn't getting caught, not in the adultery." And Bradlee says, "Yeah." And that doesn't, even he realizes how that sounds.
Yeah.
And he finally just says, "We don't control this anymore." He says, "Some little paper writes it, and then some other paper writes it, and then you get on your high horse and say you're not going to write it, and then the AP runs a story that says, 'Why won't the Washington Post cover the story that everyone else is covering?'" He said, we don't get to make that choice anymore. And I think that was really the decision on a part of more established media. A lot of the bigger papers at that time was that they were just kind of carried by this current and couldn't figure out how to navigate their way out of it and didn't want to. And I think that took hold in our business, even in the time that I've been covering politics, where we often behave as if we don't have choices, as if we are carried by this current. And we've erected all kinds of rationales for why these stories matter. But the bedrock feeling is that we just don't have a choice. And it's the thing that I come around to in this book, without giving too much of the end away. But it's a thing I come around to of, I think we do have a choice. And that's really the only message I have, is that I think we abdicated some responsibilities to make judgments and decisions that we make every day and absolutely can make.
There is no question. I mean, I'll presume about you, but, I've worked in newsrooms where there's only, there are limited resources to cover things. If you're putting your star people on following a politician around to find out what they've done, what they're spending personal money on, not taxpayer money, not donor money, there are other stories, other issues that are not being covered, full stop.
Yeah, I think there are opportunity costs, certainly, in the coverage decisions that you make. But I also think it just becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy where reporters know the stories that get them attention and get them kudos. And the more you do those kinds of stories, the scandal story, it's not just about sex. It's everything. It's, you know, a few months after Hart gets out of the race, Joe Biden is nearly drummed out of politics forever. We've forgotten this because he was drummed out of the presidential race because once when he was exhausted in Iowa, he told a story he'd been telling 100 times and just didn't credit it as he had the other times to its source. And he gets accused of a kind of plagiarism, or whatever the verbal equivalent of that is, the oratorical equivalent. And he's drummed out of the race, disgraced. I mean, it's the gaffe, it's the tax, it's, you know, whether you forgot to pay your taxes or the dumbest thing you've ever said. It's you know, as Bob Kerrey, the former senator, said to me, you know, we're not the worst things we've ever done in our lives, and there's a tendency to think that we are. And what we do is erect a kind of political journalism where you are the worst thing you've ever done, or at least the worst thing you've done lately. And the problem is, the more you do that, the less of a window you get into the actual worldview of a politician. The less they want to be around you, the less they want to show you, the more afraid they are to speak in nuance, the more afraid they are to advance any kind of idea. And when politicians aren't advancing ideas, and you're not trying to figure out what their ideas or their worldviews are because you're so busy trying to assess their character, then you get a lot of candidates who have no ideas but seem just like everybody else. And suddenly you can glide through the process on personality or celebrity without really having to know anything at all. And I think that's where we are in our politics, and I think that's what voters find so disconcerting so much of the time.
Do you think Americans believe that character is immutable to the extent that one cannot be an unfaithful spouse and a dutiful public servant?
Well, I think Americans believe character matters. I don't think there's any question. It always has. That's always been a part of politics. It becomes a more current term and concept after Watergate and particularly after Hart. But certainly some measure of character always mattered. But I think the public also understands, by and large, that truthful people tell lies and moral people do immoral things, and that there's a context to a life. There's a totality to all of our lives. None of us, I don't, you don't, nobody listening wants to be judged by their worst moment. And I think some of the rationales we've erected in my industry don't really pass muster with the public and shouldn't. I mean, the one you're really kind of alluding to is, right, if he'll lie to his wife, he'll lie to the rest of us. Well, we know that's not. We actually know that's not true, right? We can go throw Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson and John Kennedy out of office and Dwight Eisenhower and, you know, you can,
Thomas
we can
Jefferson.
Figure out. Thomas, yeah, well, go all the way back, sure. But, you know, you can, just looking at the 20th century, which I think is the most relevant, I mean, we can figure out another way through the Great Depression and World War II and the Great Society and the Cuban Missile Crisis and all the rest of it. And you can have 25 terms of the Carter administration, and maybe that's better. But I think we know that that great leaders can also be unfaithful husbands, and you don't have to admire it. Maybe you even want to know about it, but I think you have to judge it in context. And I think what we really lost in our journalism, in our political journalism, is context. We boil you down to the thing we figured out about you, the flaw that we're always looking for, the character, the thing that makes your character insufficient to lead. And we don't talk about the totality of your record. You know, Rick Hertzberg, writing in the New Republic at that time, wrote a piece about Hart, and a very prescient piece, and he said, if Gary Hart's a liar, surely there's proof in the public record. Let it be produced. And it wasn't, because actually Gary Hart hadn't lied to his constituents. He hadn't lied to his colleagues. He hadn't ducked tough votes. He hadn't done the bidding of his contributors. He hadn't gotten wealthy. He hadn't taken bribes. None of that. And that's the totality of a public life, and it needs to be gauged that way.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Sandra in Dallas. Hi, Sandra.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yes, I was wondering if you investigated the involvement of Karl Rove, because he was working for the Bushes at this time.
any appearance of Rove here, Matt?
There's not. And I don't think that's quite true that Karl Rove was working for the Bushes at that time, although I'd have to go back and look at it. I think it's too early. But I will say, I'll say this, Sandra. There are a lot of conspiracy theories among Hart people about this over the years. And, you know, Bush had been head of the CIA, and he certainly was happy to get Hart out of the way. He ends up with Michael Dukakis, who I think was a much better opponent for him. And so there's always been innuendo about who might have been behind this. But, you know, I found the woman who tipped off the Miami Herald to this story. I tracked her down for the first time, and She's not a CIA operative. She actually was a sort of jealous, frustrated friend of Donna Rice, the woman involved in the scandal, who we haven't even named yet, I guess. But, you know, she was, everyone from that time remembers, she was actually a friend of Donna Rice who was jealous and angry and felt that Hart had been paying more attention to her, but she thought he was a sleazebag. And then Donna couldn't shut up about him, and she was showing her the photos, and how dare he think he could get away with this. And, you know, she really makes that call for the, you know, as history always turns, you know, for the pettiest of reasons. And Donna Rice, certainly, you know, whatever anyone thought, she was not a setup. She was a Phi Beta Kappa, a very successful, from University of South Carolina, a very successful saleswoman for Wyeth Pharmaceuticals, an aspiring actress and model who really liked Gary Hart, had now seen him a couple of times, really enjoyed him, didn't know very much about politics, felt horrible about getting caught up in it, was deeply disgraced, worked a long time to rebuild her life. So she was not a setup. So I think at the end of the day, whatever the conspiracy theories, this was more of a human tragedy than a political setup.
It does seem stunning how quick our culture is to jump on women who have been involved in these things. And the other, of course, example would be someone like Monica Lewinsky.
Sure. I mean, you know, it's funny when this happens, not funny, but strange, you know, when this happens to Donna Rice, there is no playbook. She has no one. You know, everyone else who comes after can see what happened to other women. What did other women do? Donna Rice is really the first caught in this kind of scandal. And all she wants is to go home. You know, she says to them right away, she says to the campaign, I didn't do this. I don't want my name out there. I don't want to be, I just want to go home. And of course her name gets out and she's grilled by the campaign. She's comes back to Miami and she realizes at some point when she's surrounded by helicopters and photographers on boats and neighbors renting out their places that she really can't ever go home again.
Matt Bai is my guest. He's national political columnist for Yahoo News and a former correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. His new book is called All the Truth is Out, The Week Politics Went Tabloid. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or you can email think@kera.org. Also, you can send a tweet to me at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Matt Bai of Yahoo News, author of the new book, All the Truth is Out, The Week Politics Went Tabloid. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Did the Hart case, Matt, launch the era of the professional campaign intelligence specialist? These people who look for every possible bit of unpleasant reality, either to protect their own candidate against having it be used against them or to skewer an opponent?
It had a lot to do with it, yeah, Chris. Because that was happening. That was going to happen again, inevitably. But the Hart thing sends a very strong signal. So what happens is the first instinct of these new political operatives, because this is really the beginning of the consultant period. I mean, consultants are just becoming big business, wealthy and famous. And of course, a few years later, you'll have the arrival of James Carville and Paul Begala, and then your campaigns really begin to elevate consultants. And the first thing that occurs to all these folks is, wow, this is bad because our candidate can be undone in a matter of hours, right, by private behavior we've never really worried about. And a lot of these guys are younger and they knew this was coming. This was not news to them. But then the second instinct, right, for the really smart politicians and consultants is, but if you can turn this torpedo on your opponent, you can actually do a lot of damage that you wouldn't be able to do some other way. So, you know, Newt Gingrich, for example, realizes very quickly, a backbencher in Congress who'd actually been allied with Hart on some of the military reform stuff. You know, Gingrich realizes, well, I can't beat Jim Wright, the House Speaker, at the ballot box, but I bet I can do some damage on character. And they trump up this scandal about Wright and his book royalties. Personally, I'm in favor of people making all the money they can off books, but that's a different thing. And end up taking down a speaker for the first time in history. John Tower, another Texas figure, ends up being the first nominee submitted to the Senate for a cabinet post who gets rejected by a majority of the Senate over innuendo about his personal behavior. I talked about what happened to Joe Biden months later. That was a campaign operative for Michael Dukakis who leaked that video to Maureen Dowd at the New York Times. So instantly, the focus on character, the idea now that character is going to be the main issue in our campaigns, because that is really what happens after Hart, opens up a huge lane for opposition research and leads us really to sort of the professionalization of that kind of scandal research and mongering that we have today.
Well, you mentioned Newt Gingrich, who, of course, had his own share of scandals related to his personal life. We have an email here from Lloyd who writes, "I find it interesting that if a liberal politician makes a morality mistake, it is not forgotten or forgiven. When a conservative does something similar, it seems to go away." Do you think that's accurate, Matt? Is there a political bias to this kind of reporting?
I've heard that, Chris, and it didn't occur to me. I can't say I've really researched it or thought it through enough to say, well, is there a bias about it? I think it's probably, maybe you could make the case that because there's so much more of a theological, a religious strain through Republican politics, that sort of sin and redemption are it's just an easier path to travel in Republican politics. But I don't know. I've never thought of it as a particularly partisan issue. I mean, you look at you look at Bill Clinton, a few years after Hart, and has a completely different skill set than Hart. He's just as brilliant. I mean, I think intellectually they're very similar, but Clinton, of course, has this tremendous ability and need, real emotional need to sort of circumnavigate scandal and get around it, and he'll subject his family to a different level of scrutiny and himself to a different level of scrutiny and emoting in public. And he just sidesteps Jennifer Flowers, goes right around that scandal, and he's a Democrat. So I don't really subscribe to that theory, and I don't talk about it in the book, but I can't say, that I've researched it carefully.
Could Gary Hart, if he chose to, have done something to somehow redeem himself politically?
Well, that's an interesting question, because the answer is probably yes. It becomes pretty clear within a couple of years or less after the scandal that there is a way to come back from this, right? He watches Clinton do it and others in the culture and in politics. And, people tell him, do the interview with someone like an Oprah Winfrey, right? Or write a tell-all memoir or do a lecture tour, right? He can go to People Magazine and get on the cover of My Story, right? And there are ways to come back from something like this. Even for Hart, who was really probably more stigmatized by scandal because of that moment and what it meant in the culture, he was probably more stigmatized than any other politician of the era. But even for him, there was probably a path. But he doesn't, because his feeling is, A, that it's nobody's business and remains nobody's business. B, that he's not going to drag his wife or his children or Donna Rice or any of the other people associated with it back through that. He doesn't think he has to apologize for his private life. He doesn't think he should be groveling for forgiveness. The question it raises for me is, how are we going to define character? Because is character in a leader, the guy who goes away for 27 years, though he's desperate to serve the public in some way because that's all he's ever wanted to do in his life, and he tries and is rejected, but he won't go do all of those things. He won't hire an image consultant and plan his rehabilitation because he doesn't believe it's your business, and he does not going to do that to his family, and he doesn't think he should have to grovel for your approval. Or is character in a leader the person who will say and do anything, plot the comeback, lie if necessary, drag his wife in front of the cameras, drag his children out in public, do whatever it takes to get back that prize because he so needs the public's approbation? I mean, I would submit to you that for most of the life of the country, what we considered steadfast leadership was more associated with the former, and that we actually changed in some way fundamentally in this era the definition of what is character and what creates fitness to serve. And at a time when I think the country has needed to hear some difficult truths that would not be popular, and some difficult answers to problems we've really not solved for the decades since Hart first talked about them, including stateless terrorism and energy independence and the transition, the wrenching transition in the economy. Maybe the person who would do anything to be popular wasn't the prototype of the politician that was going to best serve us.
You know, the things that you just mentioned are complicated issues, right? They take work to fully comprehend and to separate out nuances in position when they exist. And I suppose they exist less and less now because the two parties are so diametrically opposed. But I wonder if that's partly to blame, a kind of intellectual laziness on the part of American voters.
Well, I don't know. I tend not to blame voters. I certainly think these things are related, but I tend not to blame voters. That's why we have leaders, right? Voters, voters don't want to hear difficult truths, and these are hard issues for voters to understand, and they can't be expected to chart the way forward. They're not professionals in the arena. They're living their lives. They're great at the things they're great at. They're not policymakers, It's always incumbent on the leaders of the country to stand up and say, look, I know this is tough, but I'm going to convince you, I'm going to persuade you that this is the course forward because it's the only way for your children to get the future you want them to have. And I certainly think we have lacked largely, not entirely, but largely for that kind of leadership and partly because we have become a political culture that's mostly about celebrity and character and not about ideas and that likes a story more than we like the hard truths and that attracts a kind of candidate, a kind of politician because of the unendurable process we've created who may not be ideally suited to telling you things you don't want to hear. So I think there's a relationship. I don't really put it on the voters. I put it on the politicians. I put it on the media.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Ed in Arlington. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Mr. Bai. You may have just answered my question, but the question is, don't you think that Mr. Hart bears some responsibility for this state of affairs? Wouldn't a better course of action for him perhaps been to have manned up and said, look, guys, I'll answer questions about my thoughts on Middle Eastern policy or domestic tax policy, but I'm not going to take any questions about my marriage or my views of the opposite sex. I'm not running on that. That's not what I'm here to talk about. Don't you think that would have gone better for him? Or maybe do you think he could have even said that and remained as a candidate?
Well, that's a terrific question, Ed. There are people, including some close to Hart, who've been angry at him for many years for allowing this standard to get set, for not standing up to it and trying to work through it. It is possible that he could have gotten through. But I think you have to understand, and if you read the book, you sort of get the full picture. But I think you have to understand the circumstances he was facing after those 5 days of scandal, because the Washington Post, at Ben Bradley's direction, and with Paul Taylor, who you heard in that audio earlier in the news conference, they were getting ready to run a story about another affair with a woman. And, Hart had been, we didn't talk about this, it's a very important part of the story, but Hart's been twice separated from his wife at this point. He's had years of dating in Washington, openly. He stays on Bob Woodward's couch at one point when he's not with his wife, and, nobody ever writes about it. He's been in public life a long time, and he's lived by a set of rules. And those rules enabled him to live a very active private life. So he knows that the Post now has photographs of another woman that he has seen over the years seen while he was separated and then possibly afterward. They're going to get ready to run these photos. And one of the things he says to a lot of the people close to him is they're going to drag all these women out now. They're going to go dragging them through the mud. And one woman, he said, sends him a note and says, I'm going to kill myself if they knock on my door. And he really is at that point calculating not just his own political ambitions, but he's calculating the fallout to everybody else, to his reputation, to their reputations. Is he going to ever be able to talk about issues again? And the polls really showed that the public was with him. They really thought that the media had overstepped in a sense. And, that may not have held up. It probably wouldn't have. But he was certainly winning in the public relations battle to that point where Paul Taylor asked that question. But, he says to his press secretary the night before he ends his campaign, this is never going to end, is it? And his press secretary, Kevin Sweeney, says to him, well, you'd know that better than I would, Senator. Meaning, you know, it just depends on what you've been up to. And I think Hart, you know, in that moment makes the determination that he can't transcend it without doing an awful lot of destruction. And I think it's hard to second guess that because it's hard to stand in his shoes and be the first person in that position and have to think about what that's going to mean.
What sort of emotions does he display when you talk to him today about the loss of his political career, realistically, kind of in what should have been its apex?
Well, it was very difficult for Hart. And, you know, I should note, Chris, that just this past week he was named Secretary Kerry's special envoy to Northern Ireland. It is the first time in almost 30 years that he's been given an official capacity in government. I mean, Hart didn't need, he says, and I believe him actually, that he didn't need to be president, that the presidency, he believed he'd be a great president, and I think he still believes it. But that wasn't his be-all and end-all. He needed to serve. All he ever wanted to do was be in government. He didn't make a ton of money. He didn't want to do other things. He wrote books, and he got a PhD in the years after from Oxford, and he taught, and he led some very important commissions for government commissions, but he really volunteer commissions. But he really wanted to be engaged, and he asks Bill Clinton, whom he gave his first job in government, in politics when he was running the McGovern campaign in 1972. He asks Clinton time and again, and I quote those letters in the book, to help him get some kind of assignment, to let him serve, to let him be of value. That's really what he wanted, and he's just too toxic. And it's part of this one, the chapter, what I call exile in the book, and it's the seventh chapter, is probably my favorite because it really is this, I think this just human, tragic, compelling story of how the years play in this man's life as he sits in this cabin and thinks about what might have been and tries to get back in the game. I think it moves people.
Will we ever go back? Will there be, I mean, do you think this book will touch off a hunger among Americans and people within the media to at least focus less on truly personal details of candidates' lives and look at character as it relates to public service?
Oh, gosh, that'd be quite an ambition, Chris. I'd be pretty happy if readers like me who love general nonfiction, you know, literary nonfiction, just great stories, would just pick it up and read it. You know, that would make me happy. I'm not a journalist who ever is trying to, you know, get everybody to adopt my way of thinking. It ricochets how it ricochets. But I'm always optimistic about politics and journalism because I'm optimistic about generational change. I think it's hard for people who've been in one paradigm to shift it, but I think we get so many new sources of information now and younger people coming into the business. And I do think that this book is resonating strongly with younger colleagues of mine who know that something's wrong and know that it has to change.
Matt Bai is national political columnist for Yahoo News, former correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. His new book is called All the Truth Is Out, The Week Politics Went Tabloid. Matt, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for making time for us.
No better way to spend an hour. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.